Hi, this is Paul. As you can see, I am back in my office. I have returned to Sacramento after my trip to Grand Rapids and Chicago and all of the places around there that I went. It was a great trip. I've been doing a bunch of Synod videos, and I think the Synod videos will... the channel will probably revert to the mean at some point. I'll try to incorporate some of my reflections during Synod on issues that I treat on the channel pretty regularly. And so those of you who are just impatiently waiting for the Synod videos to end, they will come to an end at some point. The order in which I did this video is a little unusual. I am still have some jet lag, and so I woke up about 3:30 this morning, ready to engage the world, and so I spent between 4 and 6 working on a PowerPoint, just like the old days on my channel. And because my wife and I, the dishwasher died while I was gone, and so we're putting in a new dishwasher this morning, and so I had to hang around. I did a Substack and a tweet thread before I did the video instead of after, and what that means is that there will probably be more development in the video than there was in the Substack or the Twitter thread. And the title of the Substack that finally emerged was "The Christian Reformed Church Needs to Learn to Fight More Productively. Like an unhappy couple, the confessing and affirming CRC must clarify their assumptions in order to rearrange their relationship or get a divorce." And if you're interested in that, I'll put the link below. It was basically launched by a conversation I was having on Twitter with Noah Livingston, who I believe is an RCA pastor, and the RCA and CRC have sort of been on parallel tracks. There's some significant differences, and he tweeted, which brings me back to my first question for all, Paul Vanderclay et al., who think now is the time for a confessional conversation in the CRCNA. Whom do you imagine having this conversation? And my friend Randy Blacketer liked it. Randy is a reformational historian, theologian. He's translating Calvin's Institutes. He's ordained in the CRCNA. Anti-Christian nationalism, patriarchy is pagan. That'll give you a sense of where Randy is at. And I've known Randy. Randy was a classmate of mine in college and seminary. And so these are the ties that one has, especially if you take a trip back to Western Michigan, which is sort of the center of it all for a lot in the CRC. Now, I've been talking about a confessional conversation for at least 10 years in the Christian Reformed Church because I want the Christian Reformed Church to have better conversations around which it disagrees. And so in that sense, what has developed in this little corner of the internet is not unusual for me because I've been asking for better conversations for a very long time, even before I started making videos about Jordan Peterson or having conversations with Jonathan Peugeot and John Vervaeke and many other people. There's a lot of theological talking past each other that a good confessional conversation would address. A lot of people have had questions about this over the years, and in many ways, John Vervaeke's Dialogos is quite similar to what I've imagined for confessional conversations. Often, sort of on the CRC affirming side, people talk about conversations as, well, this is something that is going to convince people. We need to have a conversation, and it sort of becomes code for what Agent Smith does in The Matrix when he sticks his hand in someone and they become another Agent Smith. It's not what I'm talking about. It's a confessional conversation in that it has to operate according to how confessions are supposed to operate. And even if at the end of the conversation two individuals or two churches or two denominations basically decide that their confessional assumptions, a friend of mine, Pete Van de Beek, made a comment. I actually got on Facebook to post some of these pieces because for the CRC, there's a lot more people on Facebook than on Twitter, and I'm not on Facebook much, and so I usually don't even go there, but I posted this there, and my friend Pete Van de Beek made the comment that, you know, maybe these should be called presuppositional. And there's certainly a relationship between confessions and presuppositions. I think confessions are supposed to bring our presuppositions to the fore and express them so others can understand us and so that we can hopefully have more productive relationships even when we disagree with things. but a confessional conversation should be sort of like John Vervaeke's Dialogos, where both people will leave the conversation feeling that they've gained something and earned something. Maybe they haven't changed their position. Maybe they haven't gone over to the other position, but at least they understand each other better. And I think on the whole, the world is a better place. These are only a few salient points that emerge in the human sexuality conversation. All the synod conversations are there. I would not hold it against anyone to sit down and listen to all of it based on the number of hits they get. Most of the people watch it live and then hardly anybody goes back to it. I have aspirations of going back and pulling some things out and using them as I continue to analyze and integrate my experiences in Synod with the rest of my Consciousness Congress and the rest of my life and the rest of my commentary and all the things I make commentary on. But we'll see if that emerges, because it was a very salient experience for me. But listen to the debate. On Twitter, of course, you can get some funny things. And so someone made, you have Jesus and John Wayne, now a very famous and popular book in some circles by Kristen Cobez de May, who is a professor at Calvin University. She also worships at one of the churches that I attended when I was in Grand Rapids. When I go to Grand Rapids, well, I don't usually have a car, so Church of the Servant is close to the Calvin dorm, so I can walk there. The other church I went to was Woodlawn, and it was quite interesting going to those two churches and looking at the contrast with them. And again, because I went to school for so long in Grand Rapids, I inevitably bump into people I know, and for me, that's all more data. But Josh Dawes kind of whipped up, you know, Jesus and John Lennon. To get at this point that I've made in many videos, also the great article that was on Pathos, How the Civil Rights Movement Converted White Liberal White Protestants to Secularism. Western culture war is a Western Christendom culture war. If you go all the way back to my earliest videos and analyzing the Jordan Peterson thing, you'll see that I have been making that point for a very long time. Both sides of the debate grow out of Christianity. They just grow out of competing values within Christianity and competing priorities within how the groups read the Bible. And that's exactly the kinds of things that confessions are supposed to illuminate. Tom Holland has made this point both in his book Dominion and I believe it's episode 47 in The Rest is History, where he had a special episode on culture wars, and he made the same point there. Confessions illuminate which biblical themes have priority for a community. Now, CRC Voices is a place that I hash a lot of this stuff out, especially with all the particular CRC stuff. If I don't remember to put CRC Voices, a link to them in the notes, remind me in the comments, and I'll try to put a note in. They're a listserv of conversation surrounding the Christian Reformed Church, and they're a very good listserv. I have friends on there. I've been on that group for probably 25 years, and I have friends on there, some of whom that I met with when I was in Grand Rapids. We usually have a little get-together whenever Synod happens, and we have people on different sides of the aisle, but what we share are lots of history, lots of respect, lots of bonds of love and fellowship. And what that means is that, in fact, we can debate even the more intensely, because what happens on social media is two people debate and then they sort of strawman each other and you just wind up having brick walls. But because there's so much trust and history, yeah, we wind up repeating a lot of points, but we don't divorce from each other. We stay in the conversation and we continue to learn from each other and go back and forth. And that's part of the reason that I find CRC Voices so very valuable. Confessions illuminate which biblical themes have priority for a community. Confessions express the cultural assumptions and their contextual concerns of their day that shape the implicit interpretations of the Bible. Two of the Christian Reformed Church's confessions, formal confessions, are 16th century documents that arise right out of the conflict of the Protestant Reformation, one by Guido de Bray and the other by Olivianus and Ursinus, the Belgic Confession of the Heidelberg Catechism. The Canons of Dort are a century later, and sensitive readers will note that the under girdings of the European philosophical and religious conversation had changed quite a bit between the time of the Heidelberg Catechism, the Belgic Confession, and the time of the Canons of Dort. And those things are not inconsequential in terms of how those documents should be read. But all of those documents are in some ways expressing presuppositions and stating what the churches believe. And for this reason, confessions are often polemic documents, and the Canons of Dort certainly is. But then confessions go to shape communities in the future, and so they wind up having a very dynamic relationship with the church as churches move forward. One of the things that struck me as I was reflecting on this morning, even before I got out of bed, and once I was thinking about this as I was laying in bed and thinking about part of the conflict that is going on in the Christian Reformed Church between, I am now, my last video, I tried out some nomenclature and I'm still using it, because when a conflict gets this intense, the nomenclature itself becomes problematic. And so I'm always looking for labels that both sides at least can tolerate, but labels that are accurate, and they're not straw manning, and they're not, they're trying to illuminate and not just take cheap shots at each other. You can see if you're a pastor in a conflicted church environment, you get very used to trying to have better conversations and practicing Vervaecian dialogos, because you have to do it all the time over issues that both sides very much believe are ultimate. So in the CRCNA and the Christian Reformed Church of North America, both sides of the debate will acknowledge the Belgic Confession's two books. Now, the way this debate plays out, and you can watch hours of it in the synodical deliberations, one side usually says, you're failing to love your LGBT brothers and sisters, and if you'd only really know them, if you'd only hear the stories, then you would see it my way. That's what the affirming camp says. The confessing camp says, what is unclear about the Bible? Don't you know God's law and that Christians follow the law of God? I understand that's a difficulty, but you know, if you were a real Christian, you would follow the law of God, and this is the rule for the church, and we cannot stray from it. So there's the debate. And most of the people that stood up at Synod, well, sometimes they'd have a pragmatic argument, but most of the people who stood up at Synod made one argument of the two, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, like ping pong. And as usual, it gets nowhere. But for the confessors to say the affirming don't believe the Bible, well, let's take the affirming at their word. They are reading the Bible, but they're reading it in a different way, and they're bringing up some themes of the Bible and prioritizing over some of the themes of the others. It's the assumed nuance of reading these two books that creates the spectrum the two books fall into. So it's not only the different ways they read the Bible, it's also a slightly different valence that the physical world has. Now, those of you who have been watching the channel for a long time, when I put my hands up like this, you know, sort of hand signals, you know what's coming. Upper register, heaven, mind, spirit. Lower register, earth, matter, flesh. Now, in the human sexuality debate, we might as well say heaven, mind, spirit, gender, as a cultural layer. And below, we might say earth, flesh, matter, sex. Now, it is not good and bad. That would be Gnostic. Reality lies at the intersection of the two registers, okay? And so a lot of this is about the intersection and how these two things actually interrelate and the valence that is assumed within them, especially when it comes to all of these new developments with respect to identity. It's the assumed nature of the reading these two books that creates the spectrum the two groups fall upon. This is why we need a confessional conversation to tease out the nuance, and the Human Sexuality Report expresses one side. As one person noted to me somewhere, I think it was probably on Voices, the Human Sexuality Report reads much more like a confessional argument. And I think in a lot of ways they're right. And that's partly because of the way that the report came about. Now, the upper and lower registers and what's going on in this is actually a very long conversation that goes all the way back to, well, we've got nominalism, we've got the emergence of deism, and in many conversations before, during, after the Reformation, the Scientific Revolution, these issues come into play. And we'll find similar conversations going on in different spaces. This is very much part of the concern in, let's say, the IDW space or the heterodox sense-making space. And two of the people that have been quite vocal have been Mary Harrington and Paul Kingsnorth. Now, there's a ton of nuance and complexity going on in here, but for those of you who aren't up to date on the Paul Kingsnorth stuff or who Mary Harrington is, there are some interesting conversations on Rebel Wisdom and on many of the channels that are in this little corner of the internet or at least adjacent. Benjamin Boyce had a terrific conversation with Mary Harrington that I clipped up quite a bit and used in some of my videos. Now, in the Confessing CRC, the God of creation gave you a sexual body, lower register, and God expresses his will through the physical aspects of that body. Now, lower register tends to be, but isn't exclusively, emergent. Upper register tends to be, but isn't exclusively, emanation. And so the Confessing CRC begins with the assumption, the valence, okay, of the second book, the book of general revelations. When I talked about two books, I talked about special revelation, general revelation. And again, there's to some degree some correspondence with upper and lower register type things with that approach. So again, for the Confessing CRC, the God of creation gave you a sexual body, and God expresses his will through the physical aspects of that body. In other words, God made you male and female with sex. All right? When we live in a fallen world, so when there is a disconnect, let's say, between sex and gender, the physical aspect should have priority. That's a deep assumption among the Confessing CRC. It's a very deeply Christian position and not a Gnostic position because, again, it goes all the way back to the beginning of Genesis and the goodness of the physical world. Okay? It's a deep theme within Christianity, and that comes through the Confessing CRC position. It also comes through the Roman Catholic position, the Orthodox position. Most of the historic Christian positions have that very strongly. Now, the affirming CRC, now I don't want to strawman anyone, but when I listen to them debate, and you can hear it on the floor of Synod, you hear a lot about what I would call the secret sacred self. Again and again and again in the floor debate, you hear things like, God made them. One delegate continued to say, well, what God calls, the church can't say no to. Now, those of you who are a little salty still about the Protestant Reformation will say, see, that's where that thing that you started goes. Martin Luther imagined that, you know, God was speaking to him through the Bible and not through the authority of the church, and therefore, if he had listened to the authority of church, he would have shut up and submitted, et cetera, et cetera. So these themes are long within the Protestant Reformation. These are very old conversations. But you hear a lot, well, God made me gay. Now, again, for the confessing side, they would say, no, God made you male and female. That's your sex, and gender should flow out of sex. There can be conflicts between, but in a sense, the sex, the lower register, has the minority report. It has, should basically have the weight. God made the gay person to be same-sex attracted. You'll hear that stated a lot of times. Now, I'm not going to go into it in this video, but this very much gets into the God number one, God number two issues that I've pointed out many different times. How, well, the as I find myself now through, this is what the 73 report said, through no volition of my own, I find myself same-sex attracted, whether or not I wish to be. And that sort of gives birth to the born this way argument, which also made its appearance a number of times during Synod. And the transgender person, the true self, is the male trapped in a female body. Now, Carl Truman takes a long look at that in The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, which is the more technical book, and Pete was talking about a subsequent book that he wrote that I think is a little less sophisticated and more for a general audience, and my friend Pete was recommending that book. But that's where you get the sense that I'm a man trapped in a female body or something of that nature. Oppressed, and then you have the long-running Rousseauian, you know, all these two-level theories, Marx, Rousseau, and Freud, where, well, what we need is liberation from society, liberation from social constructs, liberation from institutions, and this sort of becomes the eschatological salvation story. The salvation story is when the man trapped in a female body is liberated now through technology to become a true woman. And that's where you get the whole fight about what is a woman. And if you push that and you watch I haven't had a chance to watch the, see the Matt Walsh thing. Well, that, if for that reason, that question becomes problematic. What is a woman? A woman is anyone whose secret, sacred self manifests as a woman, where obviously the confessionals would say a woman is a human being of the female sex. And this is also where you get the continual pressure to say that sex itself is a social construct and that sex is assigned at birth. And again, that's the lower register versus the upper register. And in that sense, the secret sacred self is upper register. It's immaterial. Okay, it's experienced. This is the upper register. Sex is the lower register. For the affirming CRC, the will of God is expressed in the upper register. It's the job of the church to restore creation. And for a lot on the affirming CRC side, you'll hear usually when they have their articulations of the gospel and the Christian life, you hear this constant drumbeat. It's usually associated with a particular strain of the thinking of Abraham Kuyper, that we're here to renew and restore the creation. And so part of the gospel mission of restoring creation is righting the wrong of the discontinuity between the secret sacred self and physical sexuality. And that then, of course, gives us the current debate that we have now. And that's why you have this practice of dead naming, where you'd have to say something like, Bruce Jenner was always Caitlyn, even when Bruce didn't know it. In a sense, Bruce needed to die in order for Caitlyn to be born, but she was always Caitlyn because the secret sacred self, you can draw lines to this, you know, is in a sense up in the heavenlies until Caitlyn is revealed to the material being that is Bruce, and then Bruce then will have to undergo a transformation. And you can read the Apostle Paul has to put on the new clothing of transformation. And I mean, you can read this through all sorts of passages in the New Testament if you want to. Now, I don't find a lot in the affirming side. You have in here, in a sense, the confessing CRC process of redemption. Again, this is very traditional, and you can find it expressed in Roman Catholic and Orthodox strains as well. The desires of the flesh war against us, the epithumia, as the Apostle Paul says. So you have a fallen mixed register, and we are to put to death the desires of the flesh, and the job of the church is to aid and encourage in that process. And it's for that reason that you have this great conflict where the affirming say, we're helping, and you heard it many times on the floor of Synod, and the confessing are saying, you're not helping, you're hurting, because they have two very different ways of approaching this issue. Again, for the confessing, The lower register is primary, and it will flow into the upper register. For the others, the upper register, the secret sacred self, this immaterial spiritual reality, so often you'll hear the true self, must be manifest in the lower flesh. But now with confessing language, desires of the flesh, well, this is coming from a whole different spiritual conversation in terms of the world, the flesh, and the devil warring against the soul, and what we must do is put to death the desires of the flesh. This realignment isn't fully accomplished in this dispensation, so one must adopt a cruciform, an ascetic, sometimes even a monastic posture in order to put to death the desires of the flesh. This is the form in which a remedy is applied. It's renunciation. The CRC camps on this aren't clear and distinct. Same-sex marriage, for some, especially in the middle, is seen as an accommodation. And so for individuals for whom that cruciform path is too hard to reach the ideal, this is an accommodation that perhaps is better than another. And that's, in a sense, the kind of negotiation you have when you have an ideal. Now, this is one of the things that I thought about in discussing some of this on Twitter. Once, and in a number of videos, I've talked about the fact that if the church would talk about ideals rather than simply prohibitions and law, it might further the conversation. But there's a nasty bit of this in that once you have an ideal, you will have a margin. Once you have an ideal, those on the margins are marginalized. And again, even though that language takes away so much agency from these victims of marginalization, ideal and margin are part of the same economy and ecosystem. I think this is part of the reason why affirmings don't want to talk about ideals, because once you have an ideal, others are marginalized by that ideal. And really, once their agency is sort of vacated, they're marginalized, in other words, they're the victim of marginalization, the language gives itself to sort of an oppression narrative. So some will say that same-sex marriage is a reasonable accommodation and preferable, let's say, to preferable to other sorts of profligacy, let's say. But that's, of course, a big debate. And again, it gets into the question of ideals versus margins. Now, the affirming also have their own process of redemption in this. You have the restoration of creation, but you have the question of, well, where do we learn about the shape of creation? And into this point usually comes the natural law conversation. Restoration of creation can get a bit Gnostic. You can have difficulty. This is in some ways back to the reason why after the turn to the text in the Renaissance, you have the Enlightenment, which is a turn to the lower register in order to try to achieve consensus and community based on the physical world. And out of this arises all of these ideas of objective reality, all of which held sway over modernity. And because of these tensions, this is part of the reason why the current debate far afield of the church is playing out the way it is now, because postmodernity casts doubts on objective reality, which sort of opens the door to other narratives that can get sort of Gnostic with a secret sacred self. But again, you can look at the book of Colossians, which talks about my life is hidden with Christ in heaven. And, well, so my true life is in my Christian identity. And you have warring against the flesh. And so this is why I say both sides grow out of Christianity. It's just a difference of which values and which narratives they tend to prioritize. In the CRC, which is a moderate denomination, which means that the right and the left of the CRC are not anywhere near the right and the left that you can find further out there in the wild. Both the right and the left will be cognizant and articulate in the narrative of the other because they share so much code. All right. So same-sex marriage, sort of, as many have pointed out, sort of acting like heteromarriage, complete with children. And many have noted that in some ways, same-sex marriage, of which, let's say, Andrew Sullivan was a big proponent, is perhaps a traditionalizing of what would perhaps be imagined to be more organic or more authentic sexualities or gender identities, which wouldn't have the kinds of restrictions and the kinds of commitment and ascetic quality of marriage. For that reason, some that are more radical than what you'll generally find in the CRC will denounce marriage as a hopelessly patriarchal institution that should be done away with. If, again, I'd reference the conversation I had with Vaush on this, because I think what tends to happen with those groups is they begin to run into other issues, even though in practice that is increasingly becoming the norm in our culture, especially in very blue state areas like where I live. More and more people are not marrying, they're foregoing marriage, and, well, you're going to have what you have when you make that. Nobody in the CRC is arguing that because, again, the CRC is sort of a middling denomination. You don't have the extremes. Someone who would go to synod and denounce marriage as a hopelessly patriarchal institution would get no traction at synod. And they certainly simply wouldn't be terribly persuasive in that debate. In fact, making such an argument would help the other side, because it would be, see where that goes. And you can see my previous video about the slippery slope. Gender alignment therapy is changing the lower register to fit the upper register. That's a narrative of redemption for some in the affirming community. Queering, you have the perpetual changing of the lower register to fit the perpetual search for the secret sacred self. The search for the secret sacred self might in fact be terribly elusive, and someone might need to go through ongoing permutations. We as human beings change dramatically. I hadn't seen some of these individuals that I saw at this synod for 20 or 30 years. I had difficulty recognizing at least one pastor. I knew he was a pastor of that church, and I remembered him from college, and so in my mind, he was what he looked like in college and seminary. And then when I got to the church, I'm looking around and I saw someone mic'd up, and I thought, well, that doesn't, you know, I don't know who that is. But then when he spoke, I immediately recognized him as this individual that I knew. He had lost his hair, as have I, and he aged, as have I, except with my eyes looking out, I feel the same as when I was in college, and others have difficulty recognizing me, except for the fact that my face is always on YouTube, and I was quite surprised at just how many people at Synod have seen at least one of my videos, whether they watched one or not, or how much they watched. It's hard to tell, but my face was pretty well known. So what you have are people reading the same Bible. And what confessions are supposed to do is to facilitate the conversation between them with better nuance, detail, and priorities. I can hear the different priorities at work as the two sides debate. The same arguments come up again and again. Rarely does anyone say anything new in the debate. And because of that, both sides are pretty much set. Maybe I will play a little bit of video. Maybe I won't. Sometimes when I don't have any video in a video like this, it works well, because sometimes some of my videos that are old, I bumped into this when I was looking for old videos to repost. I just didn't have time or energy at the end of the day to do all that work for the channel during Synod. I noticed that, you know, long after I'd posted a video, some of them get blocked because of other content that I used on YouTube. So sometimes it's good just to make a completely clean video that doesn't have any commentary or other content from YouTube. But some of the different themes emerge here. The confessing CRC, again, the physical lower register world, God speaks through it. And the revealed word, reveal God. In other words, the two books work together in this way. You also have Calvin's third use of the law. Now, of course, having spent a considerable amount of time with my friend Jacob over at the Chicago meetup, and then Jacob drove me to Grand Rapids, for which I owe him a conversation at some point on his channel. He says he wants to do it live so he can defeat me and my Calvinism with facts and logic. An aspect of Calvinism that Jacob probably doesn't know about but would probably like would be the third use of the law, because sort of in contrast to Luther, who had such a dichotomy of law and grace, Calvin believed that the Old Testament law could be used as a guide for grateful living, and that the revelation of God was expressed in that law. Now, how exactly Christians sort of work through that law and what they hold to be ongoingly binding and the nature of that binding, given that it's an expression of gratitude and not as, I don't want to get into that whole large conversation, but that's Calvin's third use of the law. The affirming CRC very much emphasizes the themes God brings justice to the oppressed and marginalized, which is a big theme in the Bible, and you find it throughout the Old Testament prophets. This is where, however, you get into the difficulty of hierarchies and the marginalized, because hierarchies create the marginalized, and equality is assumed to be God's goal. And this is where a lot of the work of Jonathan Peugeot comes in, because Peugeot basically continues to assert, well, no, hierarchies are a better way to understand the world. And as Jordan Peterson points out, and I think he does successfully, that in fact, we must have hierarchies and we must have values in order to actually live in this world, because our cognitive capacities are reliant upon hierarchies of value. That's how we actually make our way through the world. Again, for the affirming CRC, the job of the church is to be a witness, or to push it harder, to instantiate justice, and for some to destroy hierarchies and to reshape the lower earthly sex register to conform to the upper secret sacred self register, and then you have your redemption narrative. Now, hopefully in a confessional conversation, what happens is that both sides understand a little bit better the themes with which they are reading their Bible. Because again, the confessing side can talk about justice and oppression, and the affirming side can talk about following God's law. In fact, for the affirming, seeking justice for the oppressed is, in a sense, part of God's law. And so again, in the CRC, they don't divorce the language, but it's a matter of priorities and emphases and applications within specific contexts. These themes all come out of the Bible. And now we bring our assumptions to the Bible, and we read the Bible through our assumptions. And in that sense, Pete is right about presuppositions. Now, unfortunately, these sides tend to keep talking past each other, and given that there's a lot of frustration, there's a lot of people that think, well, if I just keep making the same point again, then they'll change their mind. No, people don't work that way. If you want to change their mind, you're probably going to have to bring something new, or you change the context in which they are situated, because most people mirror their contexts. And this is, well, that's just simply a fact of human beings. And it's part of the dynamics why, if your church is countercultural, your church will be stronger. People have more motivation to be in a countercultural church than in a prevailing church. And so this is some of the nuance that I would bring to Aaron Wren's framework of positive, neutral, and negative contexts. Negative contexts will make the church perhaps smaller, but definitely stronger, because they need the church to continue to reinforce the values they wish to maintain. That's what happens in a church that is countercultural. The two groups have different priorities, and part of what a confessional conversation should do is get them out on the table. So, I hope this explains a little bit better about what I've been talking about for a decade, long before the YouTube videos, about a confessional conversation. And I want to see the church have it. I want to see it happen across the lines of confessing and affirming CRC, so they can at least understand each other and have a better argument. If in fact it comes to a divorce, which at this point it certainly looks like it will, only at this point it looks like the divorce will be either the affirming CRC leaving the denomination, or within 3 to 5 years getting kicked out of the denomination, they will have to then have their own confessional conversation, because it's easy to have unity in opposition. Once you're standing on your own, well, then you have to do the hard work. Now, because so many CRC church splits were to the right, for the most part, they just inherited their existing confessional documents and added on, like in the case of the URC, some changes in church polity, and because the prevailing issues had to do with women in office and creation science disputes, they sort of had riders on there that created at least an implicit confession, if not explicit. It would be truly interesting to see, and when I say interesting, I mean it in that way, a split to the right or split to the left, because I think what you would find is that it would be more difficult for those churches to come together. And again, this has to do with either the cultural alignment versus countercultural dynamics for a church. Now, that will vary from place to place, zip code to zip code. If, let's say, you're in a deeply red area where traditionalism and Christianity is very strong, I think in places like that, some of those dynamics would lead to stronger affirming churches, because again, they're resisting the broader population, but again, because of the way in which cultural power is flowing now, there's just so much cultural power going in the affirmative way. So that, I think, has led to some of the blindness that the affirming group has had, and I think still continues to have, about how serious the confessing element of the CRC is, and why, yeah, what happened in 2016, what happened in 2022, why the Christian Reformed Church will continue to get more conservative, not less, at least along these spectrums. I think the affirming CRC was simply blinded by all of the messaging that goes out by the major corporations and the major sense-making and all of that. And in some ways, Synod 2022 was sort of like that Saturday Night Live skit with Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle about a bunch of white yuppies in Brooklyn who are shocked that Trump is elected. And in some ways, that's what Synod 22 was. They woke up to discover the Christian Reformed Church is not what they thought it was. They woke up in the midst of, I'm going to make some videos about all of the talk about power at this synod. They woke up to discover that all of their establishment institutional power has blinded them to the realities of the church. So when the votes were counted, they didn't just lose by a little, they lost by a ton. And again, many of us outside of the bubble were not terribly surprised. I was a bit surprised by just how overwhelming the votes were, because they were not close at all. But I wasn't too surprised, because we all have our narrative biases, it tended to confirm a lot of what I've been saying about the narrative direction. So I'll continue to make some CRC videos. I don't know that they'll all come in order, but obviously for me right now, this is a big part of the conversation that we're having post-Synod. A lot of people are sort of in shock. Again, I think about that Saturday Night Live skit, because how could this happen? And there's going to be a lot that happens in the next few years. I tend to think that the purge is a little strong, but it could get that way. We'll come probably in 3 to 5 years unless CRC affirmings decide to be proactive, but that too would be a costly thing. Again, by virtue of the way that all of the landscape lays itself out, conservative CRCs can in some ways split more easily. And that's why, generally speaking, the CRC splits right and leaks left. Well, it's been leaking left for a long time, and for reasons that I've enunciated in other videos, the Christian Reformed Church is going to continue to get more conservative, at least in some of these ways, not less. And so, yep, that's why we need a confessional conversation all over the place, and why I make these videos, even though they're probably predominantly watched by CRC people, because this is what we need to do. So, hope this has been helpful, and I look forward to the comments.